next Thursday is a fast day, the 10th of Teves, the 10th of the month of Teves. It's one of the four fasts that we have to remember the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, the temple in Yerushalayim, in Jerusalem. The four, just to summarize, the four would be Tisha B'Av marks the day of the destruction of the temple itself. The 17th of Tammuz marks the breach of the walls of Jerusalem. The 10th of Teves, which is what's coming up this Thursday, marks the siege put around Jerusalem prior to the destruction. And then Som Gedalia, which is the day after Rosh Hashanah, that marks the assassination of Gedalia, who was the governor of the Jews. Basically, it was the final hope we had from the Babylonian government to be autonomous. And they assassinated Gedalia, which then led to the end of the autonomy of the Jews in the land of Israel. So those are our four fast days commemorating the destruction of the First Temple and Second Temple as well. The Tenth of Teves in particular marks the siege put on Jerusalem by the Babylonians. The Babylonians destroyed the First Temple under the leadership of Nebuchadnezzar, who was their emperor. This story is recounted in the Book of Kings 2, at the end of Book of Kings 2. And the story tells us how they put a siege on Jerusalem. It was a three-year siege. Eventually they were able to breach those walls and come in and destroy the temple. Now I'll read you the passage from the Book of Kings. This is from the Art School English translation. It says, it happened in the ninth year of Tzidkiah's reign, who was the king of the Jews at the time, in the tenth month. The tenth month of the Hebrew calendar is Teves, the month we're in right now, on the tenth day of the month. Then Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylonia, he and his entire army came to wage war against Jerusalem and encamped near it and built a siege tower around it. The city came under siege until the 11th year of King Tzidkiah. On the ninth day of the fourth month, that's referring to the month of Tammuz, the famine in the city became critical. There was no food for people in the land. The city was breached and all the men of war fled during the night by way of the gate between the walls, which is near the king's garden, etc. They seized the king, they brought him to the king of Babylonia, and they spoke words of judgment to him. So they captured King Tzidkiyahu, who was the king of the Jews. They judged him, they slaughtered his sons before his eyes, and they blinded the king. They bound him in leg irons and brought him to Babylonia. So that's the beginning of the story, and that led to the destruction. So it's a very tragic day because it's looked at as kind of the beginning of the end. And just to put it in perspective, you know, we have these days throughout the year to remember the destruction of the temple. And I think it's so important for us because it's something which is not on our minds in our daily lives typically. Maybe it should be, but it's not. We have a lot of insertions in our prayers and you know, in our daily routine that should help us remember the temple, but it's not always on our minds. But it's important for us to always recognize that something is deeply lacking in our lives, that the Jews are not bound together by a holy temple, together in the land of Israel, in Jerusalem. This unity is not there they're supposed to have. The connection to God is not there we're supposed to have. And having these periodic reminders of fast days actually helps us, you know, maintain just that connection. Because if we didn't have these days built into our calendar, we'd lose the connection. So it's important that we sit and focus and reflect upon the destruction of the temple periodically. So the fast days help us to do that. Now, the Tenth of Teves is actually very unique in its nature. And the reason for that is because there are many opinions that state if this fast day were to occur on Shabbos, you would fast on Shabbos.
We don't fast on Shabbos.
You would fast on Shabbos. It's an exception. If the Tenth of Teves fell on Shabbos, you would fast on Shabbos. Now, it's unique because even Tisha B'Av, when it's on Shabbos, you don't fast on Shabbos. It's pushed off until Sunday. The only time we ever fast on Shabbos in our calendar is Yom Kippur. And that's because it's a Torah obligation to fast. The Torah itself says you can fast on Shabbos for Yom Kippur. However, so Tisha B'Av you would push off till Sunday. Other fast days you push off. The fast of Esther we actually would we push back to Thursday. But the 10th of Teves, if it were to occur on Shabbos, we'd fast on Shabbos. Now it happens to be in the way our calendar is set, it never occurs on Shabbos. That's because we have a set calendar. In the time of Jewish history where the calendar was not set, and they began each month with testimony based on the new moon, so months could actually vary as to when they would occur, so technically it could have occurred on Shabbos. Based on our set calendar, which we have nowadays, it never occurs on Shabbos, but had it occurred on Shabbos, we'd actually be allowed to fast on Shabbos for the 10th of Teves. So the question is, you know, why? Why is this fast day so different and so serious? Even Tisha B'Av gets pushed off until Sunday, and we view Tisha B'Av as the most tragic day of the year. But to take this, you'd fast on Shabbos. Now, it happens to be it's based on the wording of a verse in the book of Yechezkel Ezekiel. The verse there is God speaking to Yechezkel. And he speaks to him on the 10th of Teves. So it says the date. It says it was the 10th month, on the 10th day, God spoke to Yechezkel. And God said, you should write for yourself the name of this day. And he uses the term in Hebrew, it's Etzem Hayom Azev, the essence of this day. And it said that was the day that the king of Babylonia encamped and put a siege on Jerusalem. And then repeats again, on the essence of this day, on this very day. So from the fact the Torah says, the prophet says, on this very day, commentaries explain that shows us that this day is not movable. God said, this is the day. We're not just marking an idea, a period, you know, some part of the calendar. We're marking this day has to be marked. You cannot ignore this day, the 10th of Teves. It can't be ignored. So that's what leads us to say that even if it occurs on Shabbos, you have to mark it on Shabbos by fasting. So the question is again, like, why is this one so different than Tisha B'Av or other fast days? So one answer given was given by a great Hasidic master, the B'nai Yisachar. He writes that, and he actually cites an idea which is discussed about Tisha B'Av. The Talmud, when discussing when the fast Tisha B'Av should occur, there's a little bit of a dispute. Because we know we fast on the 9th, the Tisha B'Av is the 9th of Av. We fast on the 9th of Av. Rabbi Yochanan says in the Gemara, he says, had I been there at the time where they were establishing this fast, I would have said they should do it on the 10th. Should have the next day. That's what he said. We should have it on the 10th, not the 9th. Why should it be on the 10th? He says, because you know, the temple was set aflame on the 9th, but most of it got burnt on the 10th. So majority of the destruction happened on the 10th of Av. Why are we fasting on the 9th? That's what Rabbi Yochanan said. So the Gemara says, hey, that's a good point. You know, how do we respond to that? Why is it we fast on the 9th? So the Gemara says it's because the beginnings of tragedy are the main tragedy is when everything begins, the beginning of the end. So we fast on Tisha B'Av, on the 9th of Av, because that's when the temple is set aflame. Okay, continue burning. But the beginning of the tragedy occurred on the 9th, so you mark the beginning of the tragedy. So therefore, the 10th of Teves, if you don't really zero in, what's the beginning of all of our tragedies? It's the 10th of Teves, because that was from that point on, the Jews were now subject to other nations. That was when we were put under siege. After that point, that day, we were under siege of the Babylonians. The temple was destroyed. We were sent into exile. And that was the beginning of the end of the first temple. And really, historically, we can look at that day as the beginning of many of our troubles. Because that was really the day that we can attribute all exile and destruction to. It was that day in the calendar. So therefore, the 10th of Teves, as that it marks the beginning of tragedy, where everything starts, the source of it all, it's where everything was initiated. Therefore, that's why it's such a serious and solemn day. And it's true that, you know, we can see it, and many commentators pointed out, that really all of our challenges and travails and difficulties we've had in exile for the past, you know, dealing with 2,500 years or so, we link them all back to the destruction of the temple. That's why in Tisha B'Av, when we mourn on Tisha B'Av, we don't just mourn about the temple, we mourn about everything. We mourn about the Holocaust, we mourn about pogroms, we mourn about the expulsion from Spain, we mourn about the burning of the Talmud, we mourn about all of our tragedies. Because everything links back to the fact that God allowed the non-Jewish nations to come in, destroy our land, destroy our temple, and exile us. And from then on, that's where everything goes downhill. So that is the severity of this day. So it's not just a day marking a siege, and the siege was a terrible thing, but it's a day marking really the beginning of all of Jewish challenge and struggle throughout history. That's the day where it began. Now, it's interesting, which is that this day of the 10th of Teves, it's actually a culmination of a three-day period of mourning and tragedy. The rabbis actually teach us that the 8th and the 9th of the month also were tragic days. Hadn't been able to fast for 3 days, we probably would have. But we only fast on the 10th because we can't really handle a three-day fast. You know, most of us would not be able to survive after a three-day fast. But the rabbis teach us really the 8th of Teves, which is actually today, and the 9th of Teves, which is tomorrow, and the 10th are all tragic days. What's the tragedy of these days? On the 8th of Teves, an event occurred, which we refer to as in Hebrew as the Targum Shivim. In English, they call it the Septuagint, right? So it's Greek. It was when I'll tell the story in a minute, but that the translation of the Torah by 70 elders for the Greek king, Ptolemy, that happened on the 8th of Teves. We'll get back to the story momentarily.
It started on the 8th.
I think it was on the, I don't know how many days, I guess it started on the 8th. I don't know how long it took them to translate the entire Torah. I don't know how long the translation went for. But I assume it started on the 8th, is what I assume. The ninth of Tevis is actually fascinating because if you look at the halachic sources, the Tur, for instance, is one of the primary sources of halacha. He says ninth of Tevis is a fast day, and he writes that the rabbis didn't tell us what it's for. So he leaves it kind of mysterious. You should fast the ninth of Tevis. It's a tragic day. The rabbis didn't tell us why. When you move into the Lashon, the language that the Shulchan Aruch uses, which is our source for modern-day halacha, he also says a very mysterious quote. He says, the ninth of Tevis, it is unknown what tragedy happened on that day. Very, very strange wording. So commentators point out very simply that that day was the day that Ezra died, the prophet Ezra of the book of Ezra. The prophet Ezra died on the ninth of Tevis. That was his yortzeit. That's what commentators point. That's what we actually say in Slichos of the day. The prayers of the day of the Tevis point out that on the ninth, Ezra died. Ezra was the great leader of the Jews who brought us back to Israel after the Babylonian exile. And he's the one who began the rebuilding of the Second Temple. He died on the ninth of Tevis. Now, commentaries all say, we don't know why these sources are so mysterious about this day. Why can't we just say Ezra died? So that's not so clear. However, there are some references to the fact that we know there's a certain Jew who was born on December 25th. We all know about him. And some say this is Hebrew birthday. That's what some say. And this, the tragedy which they're avoiding mentioning, obvious, for obvious reasons, is referring to his birth. Because for the Jews, that was a very tragic event, and everything has happened ever since then. So some say when we have this mysterious language, we're not telling you what happened on this day. We don't know what happened on this day. It's unknown what happened on this day. Some say it's actually referring to the birth of that individual. However, most sources point to the death of Ezra. That's what most sources point to. But, you know, definitely the timing, I don't know how the years work out, but the timing of years certainly comes in line with the Christian traditions on when he was born. So we have our three different events. We have the eighth. So let's talk about what happened. On the eighth day of Tevis, this translation of the 70 elders, it's actually a translation which we have in our hands this very day. Scholars use it. It's referred to as the Septuagint. It was the first official translation of the Torah into Greek. But we view it as a terrible, terrible event. It's actually found, the description is given in the Gemara, in Maseches Megillah, Tractate Megillah. It says that there was a story with Talmai HaMelech. In English they call him Ptolemy. He was the king. You know, they had the Greeks were split. They had two fighting factors of Greeks in those days. You had the what do they call them? I think the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. So the Seleucid Greeks were the ones who were in the north. They were up in Syria. And they were the ones of Hanukkah fame, I believe. The southern Greeks down in Egypt were referred to as the Ptolemy Greeks. So their king was called Talmai in the Gemara. He's the king of the southern Greeks, the ones they're down in Egypt. And he one time, he wanted a translation of the Torah into Greek. He wanted to get his hands on it. He didn't know what this thing said. So it says in the Talmud that he took 72 sages, he put them into 72 separate rooms, and he didn't tell them why they were there. So he arrested or subpoenaed them, and he put them all in their own separate room. And then he went to each one individually and said, I want you to write for me the Torah of Moshe in Greek. That's what he told them. So they didn't know that they were all 72 doing the same exact thing. And I seemingly this king was trying to catch them. You know, look, you guys are cheating me. Or he translated differently. You guys don't know what he's talking about. You don't interpret it right. I assume he was trying to frame them or catch them on something wrong. And each one, as they were translating, they had to be very careful with what they said. Because number one, accurate translation is very difficult to do. Number two, some passages translated literally could be misleading or confusing or incriminating to the Greek king. Like for instance, this is like a cute one. The Torah talks about an animal called the Arneves, which is not kosher. Now this king's wife's name was Arneves. So if you put Arneves into the translation, he'll think you're poking fun at him, or making fun of his wife. You know, she's not kosher. So there are a lot of instances in the Torah, and some also which may propose theological difficulties. So the rabbis translating it wanted to try to translate in a way which was accurate, but yet not going to incriminate them or cause misunderstanding. So the Gemara goes through several different translations they made into the Greek, several changes in the text. And it was miraculous that each of the 72 rabbis translated the Torah in the exact same way, word for word, even though they made changes to the original. They translated word for word in the exact same way. It was a big miracle. That's the story of the Septuagint, the Targum Shivim, which is the 70 elders. So ever, Jewish thought views this as a terrible occurrence. The The Talmud tells us the world was in darkness for 3 days after this. I guess metaphorically, we were thrown into darkness. The rabbis even compare it to, it was as difficult for the Jewish people as was the day where the tablets were broken, the day of the golden calf. That's how we view it. It's a terrible, terrible event. Now, why is it so tragic? I mean, we all benefit from translations. Art Scroll has made it big in America, and we all benefit from Art Scroll. The Torah translated into many languages has enriched countless lives. You know, not everybody is able to understand the Torah in the original. Why is it that this day of this, and this is really, I guess, the first translation of the Torah which was made, and is put into the hands of non-Jews? That's what happened on that day. So what's so tragic about this? So first and foremost, the fact that it was given over to non-Jews, it's the first time non-Jews really had access to the Torah on a mass level. I mean, I assume throughout history, non-Jews could have learned Hebrew, and they could have understood the Torah. But once you have a Greek translation handed over to the Greek king, at that point, the Torah becomes open for the masses. Now, once that happens, so it's left open for corruption, misinterpretation, you know, being maligned and slandered, and even for how the Jews understand it. You know, we all here in America are very influenced by society around, and the Christians, they have the Bible. And you know, there's many ways they interpret verses in the Torah which might seep into our understanding of the Torah itself. And we don't even realize it. You know, how do we picture certain things? You know, even when you picture the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. So I think a lot of us have very Christian images in our minds because we grew up in America and that's the image of the surrounding society. But it's a corruption to the truth of Torah. And I think a lot of the ideas, the impressions which are there, might you know, have been misinterpreted and corrupted, and they seep into Jewish life as well. That's one level of tragedy of this event. But it goes deeper. The Torah, as we view, is infinite. You know, this is God's word. God words things precisely. Every single word in the Torah is exact, letter for letter, word for word. It's the word of God, and the phrases that God uses are exactly as they need to allude to all sorts of levels of depth and meaning, understanding, and wisdom. The language of Hebrew, we call Lashon HaKodesh, the holy tongue. So it's the holy language of Torah. I think we mentioned a little while back, why is it called the holy language? So there's a discussion about this. The Rambam, he says simply that the Hebrew is a holy language because there's no dirty words. That's what he says. There's no dirty words. Ramban, Nachmanides, he says no, Hebrew is the holy language because it's the language which is used to express holy ideas. The Torah is written in Hebrew because every language kind of has its own facet in which it can express certain ideas. People look at, you know, French or Italian as romantic languages, and some languages are more technical and precise, and some are more dry, and some are more poetic. And Hebrew is the language which is best suited to fit Torah ideas, holy ideas. That's why it's the Lashon HaKodesh, the holy language. Now, as an aside, you know, many, many yeshivas still study in Yiddish. And Yiddish is certainly not a widely spoken language anymore, but many, many yeshivas in the world still use Yiddish as their language. And there's many explanations why, but one reason is that a lot of the ideas studied in yeshivas were developed in Yiddish-speaking societies, and the terminologies that were used when they were developing these ideas were Yiddish terminology. And we translate them into other languages, you kind of lose some of the implication of what the words mean. So every language can fit those concepts we're supposed to express, and Torah is supposed to be expressed through Hebrew. So if you express Torah in other languages, you're missing a lot of what's there. Even the letters themselves, the letters in the Torah, the shapes, the format of the letters, there's books and books written on letters. You know, what does an aleph mean? A beis, a gimel, what do they mean? Why is it shaped that way? What's the meaning of it? The letters in the Torah that are written have crowns on them. The Gemara tells us that Rabbi Akiva used to expound upon every single crown in the entire Torah. He had a lesson for every crown. So you open up your Torah scroll, and you're looking at hundreds and hundreds of crowns in the letters. And Rabbi Akiva had an answer for why every single crown was there, and he had a lesson based on that crown. Now, you put it into English or Greek or French or Spanish or Chinese, there's no, you lose that. You don't have that anymore. Yeah.
Did you once say that it's better, like when you're davening, it's better to say it in Hebrew even if you cannot, you don't know exactly what you're saying, but it is the same in English?
Yes, it's the same idea, because the words carry within them so much power, they're so precise and exact, that even if you don't understand exactly what they mean, but the words are powerful words on their own right. Additionally, we know that you can learn things in the Torah from gematria, from numerical values, which obviously are lost in translation. There's concept of notrikun, which is being able to look at the makeup of words and pull out ideas from them. The allusions and references in the Torah through the language are abundant. And if you lose out totally once it's in translation. we know that there is a written oral Torah. God at Mount Sinai gave written Torah, which is what we have in our Torah scroll, and oral Torah is an oral tradition. The oral tradition is not meant to be separate from the written Torah, it's meant to be part and parcel of the written Torah. So the scholars tell us, and the Talmud shows us over and over again, that every idea which is part of our oral tradition has some reference in the written Torah. So even though the Talmud might tell you something which seems to be totally its own idea, you couldn't find anywhere in your Chumash. You look for your Chumash, you can't find it anywhere. The Talmud will show you, yeah, but that word, that letter, that phrase, that verse really teaches you this lesson. The Vilna Gaon, the famous Vilna Gaon, it's reported that at the end of his life, he was able to just to study the words of the Chumash itself. And he says he knew so much, he's able to find every single idea of the oral tradition, of the Kabbalah, of Halacha, just in the words of the Chumash. He didn't need anything else anymore. Because everything is in there. If you know what you're doing, every single idea is found in the Chumash itself. Once in translation, it's all gone. It's all lost. The Torah is left just at a surface level. All you see is the story. All you see is the basic idea. But anything deeper than that, you can't see through translation. All these deeper references are totally lost upon us. So the tragedy of translation, number one, was that it went in the hands of non-Jews. But number two is that we've lost out on a major ability to see the depth of Torah. Because if we're just sticking to translation, which once the translation is done, so I'll have people, as we all do, say, you know, it's much easier for me to look at the translation. I don't really know the original Hebrew. It's very hard to learn the original. So I learn the translation, which is fine, but we miss out. And when that becomes something which is the norm, so Jews are missing out on the depth which is there, which you can't get through translations. So that's the tragedy of the 8th of Tevis, the translation of the Torah into Greek, it represents for us a day when the depth and the power and our clarity of Torah was diminished. It's something which is corrupted now by non-Jews, something which is corrupted by Jews. Something the Jews don't see the depth anymore and the beauty because it's in translation. The Torah is open for public consumption. Everyone can take it and do what they want with it. And without the benefits of the sages and the interpretation of the oral tradition, Torah is something which has lost a lot of meaning. And I'll take it even one step further. Like I said before, we're tempted to view the words of the Torah, of the Chumash, and the oral teachings kind of as two separate things, two separate bodies of literature. But it wasn't meant to be that way. When God gave it at Mount Sinai, He gave us the text with the oral tradition. Rav Hirsch uses an analogy. He says it's similar to you go to a lecture, and you write down your notes, the bullet points. But since you wrote the lecture, you can then expound upon the bullet points and understand the entire lecture. The Torah is meant to be, as it were, kind of the bullet points of God's big lecture at Mount Sinai. God's big lecture included the entire oral tradition. And the Torah are those bullet points. So if you go straight from the bullet points, then it's very hard to understand the lecture. But if you're at the lecture, you can understand the bullet points. But they work hand in hand. They don't work separately from one another. That's how we're supposed to view it. Now that the Torah is in translation, and now that the world has it, and non-Jews, even though they do use the Torah, but the oral tradition they don't have. Even nowadays, it's very rare to think that a non-Jew has access to, maybe they could pick up a Talmud and read it, but they don't have the oral tradition passed down from Rebbe to student and parent to child as the Jews have. And that part of the Torah, which is supposed to be the primary understanding of the Torah, is not out there. But the world thinks the Torah is what it says. And really we say, no, the Torah is not just as it says, but as it says with the oral tradition. Yeah. It's a good question. I mean, the tradition was oral. As we say, it's oral tradition. It was oral for, I don't know, 2,000, 1,000 years, 1,500 years or so. 2,000 years. It's oral for 2,000 years. Once we saw that if we kept it oral, it'd be lost because of all the persecution that we went through. So the rabbis deemed it appropriate to write it down. So as they wrote it down in a way through, as we have in the Talmud, discussions, points that people make, ideas interpreted by the rabbis of the Talmud, They recorded the old tradition in the Talmud as we have in the Talmud, but it was the same tradition that's passed down orally for the 2,000 years prior. Now, we do have disputes, which, again, is a natural result of things being oral. You could have disputes. We can't say that every single letter, we say every letter of the Torah itself, we say is exact, precise, as God said, it's no variations, that's how we view it. The oral tradition, it was oral. So you end up with a dispute, you end up, how do you do this mitzvah, how is that done, there are disputes within it. But they're writing down just what they received from their teachers dating back all the way to Mount Sinai. That's what they're writing down. They're not writing down their own personal ideas. Even if it's presented as, Abaye's idea, or Shmuel's idea, or Rabba's idea, or Rav Yirmiyah's idea, they're just interpreting that which they received from their teachers in previous generations. That's how we view the Talmud. It's not just something which they came up with one day in the year 400. It's a compilation of 2,000 years of tradition that was filtered through them. So it's what was actually given as part of the tradition is disputed. Certainly the tools to derive halacha were given, that's for sure. Certainly the explanations of the mitzvahs were given. The Torah doesn't tell you what tefillin are. It says, put totafos b'nei necha. Totafos in your eyes. What are totafos? So certainly God told Moshe orally, totafos means these black boxes, there's a shin, there's parchment inside, and there's straps. That God told Moshe that. Now halachas, which are situations that came up later on, it could be that God did not tell Moshe that directly, but God gave Moshe the tools to derive that later on. So every single situation which comes up, the rabbis orally had the tools to figure out what would God want in the situation that we had. If Moshe was given every single word of the Talmud or not, that's not so clear. Was he given every single concept? Not so clear, but definitely the tools, the ideas, the big concepts were certainly given. And the rabbis expanded upon them. That's definitely something we can say. Yeah.
I have to point out there are many cases in the Talmud where it says halacha Moshe Sinai. This specific halacha was given orally to Moshe at Sinai and was not written down
anywhere in the Torah
until 1,000 years later, 1,500 years later.
Right. That was purely oral.
No.
Right.
Somebody wanted to cite it to work out a decision about maybe a current case.
Right.
Or maybe a case that had been decided a long time ago.
Well, usually what would happen is that they were trying to, they knew a certain halacha, they would try to find a source, and they could not come up with a source anywhere, until someone says, this is just a tradition that Moshe had, and there's no source in the actual Torah for it, in the actual words of the Torah. Just a cute story, there's a great speaker, Mordechai Becher. He's a speaker, he speaks around, he's actually Australian, but he lives in America, he's involved in very much Jewish outreach. If you ever get a chance to hear him, he's very good. He tells a story that he was speaking in Texas.
What's his name?
Rabbi Mordechai Becher. I mean, his classes are online. You can download them for free. He's very good. Wide variety of topics. I really enjoy his lectures. He said he was once down in Texas teaching a class. Texas is part of the Bible Belt, in the South, where I grew up, And, so someone there in the crowd, I believe he wasn't Jewish, he kept asking him questions about the Bible. Says, but Rabbi, the Bible says this, the Bible says that, And I think the Rabbi Becher is getting a little annoyed with him. And he said, I want to tell you something. He says, Jews don't believe in the Bible. So everyone's taken aback. Jews don't believe in the Bible? The Jews don't believe in the Bible. And he's referring to the Old Testament. But he says, Jews don't believe in the Bible. So he says, what do you mean? So it's not that, because when he's quoting the Bible, he means, his King James translation as he's read it, with no commentary, no oral tradition, no oral sources, no references to the original text, nothing. That's the Bible. When you say the Torah, you mean you're looking at the original Hebrew, given to Moshe at Mount Sinai, and you're using the understandings that are passed down from generation to generation for the past 3,000 years, with the oral tradition, with the commentaries, that's the Torah. So you can't ask a question necessarily just from your King James translation with no further information, because maybe that's not what it really means. The verse means that which the Torah says. I always like that story. So So we don't believe in the Bible, as he says. We believe in the Torah. The Torah is not just the words you see on the page. So that's the occurrence of the 8th of Tevis. In the 9th of Tevis, which we said it was unclear in the sources of what happened, but that's the death of Ezra. For all intents and purposes, that's the day that Ezra died. Ezra was a person who, along with the help of Nehemiah, the two of them, you know, are in cahoots, and if you look in the prophets, they're able to help the Jews repent and come back to Israel after the first exile into Babylonia. The temple was destroyed, they spent 70 years in exile, and then the Persian government allowed them to return to Israel and rebuild the temple. So Ezra was the one who was there rallying the troops to come back to Israel. Everyone should repent, come back, rebuild, and we're allowed to take back our land. That's Ezra. Ezra, according to the final book of prophets, is the book of Malachi. But the Talmud tells us that Ezra actually is Malachi. Malachi in Hebrew, Malachi means my messenger. That's all it means, not necessarily a name, my messenger. And according to that understanding, Ezra was the final prophet that we ever had. After the death of Ezra, prophecy ended. So that itself is tragic. The prophecy ended with the death of Ezra. I mean, prophecy was our link to God, that God could communicate with us and tell us exactly what he wants and what he needs and what he wants to do. And with Ezra's death, that was lost. That's certainly tragic. But there's another level of Ezra's death as well, which connects with what we were describing before about the Oral Torah, which is, this is what I'm about to share with you, is an idea from the book Or Gedaliahu, written by Rabbi Gedaliah Shor, who was... he was a Rosh Yeshiva in New York, really one of the first great rabbis America produced back in the 20s, 30s, 40s. A very great person. He was an American through and through, but he was a very, 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 very great person. So he writes that when Ezra died, he's quoting from earlier sources as well, Ezra himself was the one who introduced the text we have in the Torah scroll. Ezra introduced that to the masses. I mean, if you look historically, the Talmud tells us this. There's two types of what are called fonts, which were used. There's something called Ksav Ivris. Ivris, the Ivrit, like Hebrew font, I guess we would call it. And then Ksav Ashuris. Ashuris is the other font. Now, the font in our Torah, which we have nowadays, in our Tefillin, in our Mezuzah, it's called Ksav Ashuris. It's Ashuris font. Ashuris. That's the one that has all the crowns. That has the letters that we expound upon. Everything we discussed before is all in this font. The other font, Ksav Ivris, was just a regular font. We don't look at that as carrying with it all the messages and secrets and fundamental ideas you find in Ashuris. So the Talmud tells us that certainly we had the Ashuris font from Mount Sinai, and that was used. However, that font was kind of reserved, the Chasam Sofer writes, was reserved for the sages, and the regular folks, the masses, had the Ksav Ivris font, just the basic font. Ezra introduced Ksav Ashuris to the masses. He said everybody should now use Ksav Ashuris in their Torah. This font, which is the font which we use nowadays, was reintroduced, we call it, and spread by Ezra. So that font gave the Jews the ability to truly understand Torah's depth, like we said. The letters we use in the Torah, the way that they're formed, the crowns upon them, those allow us to be privy to so many ideas which you wouldn't understand if you just were using any other Hebrew font. But the font we use, Ksav Ashuris, is a font which is extremely unique in that it carries within it all these fundamentals, all these ideas, and all these concepts. Initially, it was reserved for the sages, and then Ezra spread it to the masses.
We have a little question here. In between the giving of the Torah and Ezra, there was the first temple.
Right. Yeah.
So what kind of font did they use in the Torahs?
They're using Ksav Ivris, it seems. The Ivris font, the regular font, not the special font. Not the one we use nowadays.
In the temple, they didn't use the same font?
That's what it seems. I'm not for sure. That's what it seems from the sources. It's interesting. That's what it seems. However, so Ezra introduced to the masses the ability to derive so much more from the Torah itself. And Ezra simply understood that he was going to be the last prophet. And once prophecy is gone, your access to God is purely through God's Torah. When you have prophets around, so the prophet could communicate with God, people can even go to prophets and ask questions, and sometimes God would even respond to them. Once the prophets are gone, the only way we can understand God's will and God's desires in this world is through the Torah itself. So Ezra introduced to us what we use, and this is the primary font of the Torah, Ksav Ashuris. And with that came the ability to understand Torah in its depth. Now this ties in very much with what happened in the 8th of Tevis. But once the Torah is translated into other languages, and you lose that depth, So then what Ezra introduced is kind of null and void. Because if we're not using the Torah in its original, then we can't derive all the depth and meaning which we're supposed to based on the lettering and based on the wording and based on the language. The
Who changed it from Sinai to not using it in the first temple?
I'm not sure. I don't know the answer to the question. I'm not sure. Look back at the Gemara. The Gemara discusses it. The Gemara discusses this in the Sanhedrin. Also the Megillah. Discussed it a few places. The Gemara tells us that who's really greater, the sage or the prophet? The Gemara says, Chacham Adif Minavi, a sage is greater than a prophet. And well, because the prophet's limited to what God tells him. A sage can tell you what God wants even when he wasn't told by God. Because a sage is able to take the wisdom of the Torah and derive from that messages to go far beyond that which prophets were told. As the elders of the community who've worked hard and studied and developed that ability. A prophet's assigned by God. You know, God spoke
right,
it.
Right.
The sages are people which, based on their own personal efforts, they've been able to grow to the point they understand the Torah in its depth. And they can expound upon it.
Like at the beginning of the curriculum, it was handed down from the parents, smicha.
Right.
It wasn't just you earned the status.
You earned it, but it's on your own merits. It wasn't God didn't appoint you. You earned it, and then the smicha was given from the previous generation downwards. But the idea of chacham arif minavi, that a sage is greater than a navi, I don't know if that means the officially appointed sage either. I mean, somebody who has the ability to derive wisdom of the Torah, he can see further than a prophet can see, because prophets are limited to that which God lets them be privy to. A sage can look in the Torah and find everything. And that's the big difference between the two. So Ezra was giving us the ability after his death to say, there's no more prophecy anymore. You guys got to take the Torah and you got to study it hard and understand the Torah teaches you. And that's how you're going to be able to understand that which prophecy is going to be lacking here. The prophecy would have given you a lot of understanding. You're not going to have that. But you have the Torah and you can use the Torah to even become greater than prophets. But once the Torah is translated and we're not using the original anymore, and we lose that depth and that ability to understand, so then it's very hard to say we're going to be able to understand at a level greater than prophet. Because we're not able to understand all the depth of Torah, all the messages which are built into the text, into the language, into the letters, and everything else. So the ninth of the Tevis is a tragic because the last prophet died, but it's also tragic based on the fact that that prophet was trying to give us so much to understand Torah for our generations, and because of the Septuagint, because of the translation which happened on the 8th, even that's something which is much more distant from us. Now you move on to the 10th of Tevis, the 10th of the month. And that's the day we actually do fast nowadays. And that's the day of the siege on Jerusalem. Now this was, as we mentioned before, is the beginning of the end. All the destruction, the exile, everything is linked back to that day. And if we want to kind of put it in a context of these other 2 days, we want to try to find a common denominator. I mean, God doesn't work randomly. We have three tragic events that are 3 days straight. These days must have a connection in some way or the other. You know, there's no coincidences. So what's the connection of the siege of Jerusalem to this other concept of the loss of the depth of Torah? And I think it's very simple. There's this story, I may have told this back in the summer in Tisha B'Av time, but there's a story which is quoted. The sources which is quoted in are very reputable sources. They're later sources, so I can't verify historically if it occurred or when it occurred, but the message is still there regardless. But it's quoted in very reputable sources. So the story introduces a meeting of the prophet Yirmiyahu and the philosopher Plato, the famous Greek philosopher Plato. And Plato, as we know, is one of the great minds of history. And he was able to expound upon many deep questions. And he and Yirmiyah were having a discussion. And Plato posed to Yirmiyah, the prophet, all these great philosophical quandaries he had that he couldn't figure out. And Yirmiyah, the prophet, was able to answer him, you know, one by one. So Plato was astounded at Yirmiyah's knowledge. How do you know so much? And he said to him, Yirmiyah was the prophet who witnessed the destruction of the temple. The Book of Lamentations is written by Yirmiyah. Yirmiyah lived through the destruction. He prophesied about the destruction. And he's the one who had to lead the Jews at the time of the destruction. So Plato said to him, you're such a wise man. I don't understand how you know all these answers. I also don't know why such a wise man is crying over a building, sticks and stones. Why are you going in such tears, such mourning over this building over here? You're such a smart man. You know, you don't cry over spilled milk. And what was, it was just building. You move on. So Yirmiyah told him, based on this account, he said to Plato, he said, you don't understand. You're not going to understand why I'm crying. But I'm telling you, that building is what allowed me to answer all your questions. That's what he tells them. My wisdom came through that building. So the point is that the Beis HaMikdash, when it was standing and functioning appropriately, that was a conduit of wisdom from God to our world. The clarity which we had understanding the world, understanding the Torah, came through the Beis HaMikdash. There was like a pipeline of heavenly inspiration coming through that building out to the masses. The prophets especially were able to tap in to what that building offered. With the loss of the temple, that stands not just for loss of a building, not just for the loss of the mitzvahs within that building, not the loss of sacrifice, not just the loss of the Jews gathering together at a central point, but it's also cutting off of God's influx of understanding into our world. That's how we view it. There's many sources that describe that part of the major tragedy was not just the human loss, and it wasn't just the loss of the ability to perform mitzvahs, it wasn't the loss of the land of Israel, but it was the loss of a connection to God, which helps us understand God better and the world better. And that's what Jeremiah was pointing out. He's saying that everything I was able to answer was because that building stood there and I was connected with God. Now that building is gone, I've lost that connection as well. Now we think about the tragedy of the destruction as that we've lost our location, we've lost our autonomy. We think about it in a lot of different ways. But one of the biggest lackings we have is that we say when we take out the Torah on Shabbos, we say, Ki mitzion teitzei Torah, that the Torah comes out of Zion. Torah came from Zion. Understanding of Torah came from Zion. And once Zion is destroyed, once the Temple Mount is destroyed, then, it's interesting, the word Zion, we've developed into meaning a lot of different things. But I think the original meaning of it meant the Temple Mount. That's what it meant, Zion, the Temple Mount. So once Zion is lost, so then that means that Torah no longer is going to emanate from Zion at this point. And therefore, we've lost the understanding which came with the standing of the Beis HaMikdash. The ability to understand concepts which are otherworldly require us to be able to tie into another world. And once we're cut off that other world, we can't understand it the same way. We do our best, and we understand a lot, and we have great sages out there, and we gain a lot of wisdom from it, but we can't relate to that which was there prior to the destruction, because there was a depth of understanding which goes far beyond that which we're privy to. So that's how it all ties in. I would say these 3 days, on one level, all tie together as the days where we're mourning our loss of understanding the Torah to its depth. The Torah, at one point, we were able to access all of the secrets of history, all of the wisdom of the world, everything we needed was accessible to the Torah, and now we're limited. Now we still do our best, and we still understand, we still gain a lot, but we're limited in our access to Torah based on translation, based on the loss of prophecy, based on the loss of the destruction of the temple. That limits us. These 3 days, let's finish with this, they always come, you know, we're a week after Hanukkah. And again, it's no coincidences. I mean, if Hanukkah was last week, and this week we have 3 days of tragedy, there must be some link between the two. It just happened to occur this way. And I think it's very simple, which we discussed, last week or 2 weeks ago, we discussed how the menorah, the Hanukkah story represents, the light of the menorah represents the light of Torah. We say that the menorah itself, the Torah is compared to light, and the menorah was the place in the temple that represented the Torah itself. The Hanukkah story tells us that even through our exile, even through our persecution, even through our destruction, the light of the Torah still keeps on shining. Even though our access to it might be limited at this point, we realize that we're very distant and very far from fully accessing God, but yet that light keeps on shining no matter what. That's the message of Hanukkah. And once we have Hanukkah, that gives us the encouragement that despite the fact that we have 3 days of mourning over the loss of the Torah, we always keep in mind our menorahs last week, which teach us that even though we feel distant from the Torah, that light will never cease to shine. And we're able to take that Torah throughout our exile to let it inspire us and energize us. And we dive in and we pray that we should come back to Israel, rebuild the temple, and once again be privy to the full understanding and clarity that the Torah offers us. That's what we should have, we don't have nowadays. So everything does link back to the destruction. But we know that once we rebuild, God will restore the understanding, as it says that in the future, the whole land will be filled by knowledge of God. All the non-Jewish nations will come and ask us to teach them Torah, because everyone will appreciate the depth of Torah, the value of Torah, the meaning of Torah, and the inspiration of Torah. Any questions?